This is the Winning Plays Podcast on the CLNS Media Network, the leading online provider for the NBA's winningest
franchise. Welcome back to the Winning Plays Podcast. I'm Rich Levine. B-Rob is back from dad duty. It takes a lot for us to don the headphones on a Saturday, but a 32-point comeback will do it. A 60-point game will do it. So B-Rob, let's do it. Where do you want to start today? You got the 32-point comeback by the Boston Celtics or the Jason Tatum show? 60 points should have been 61. We could talk about that maybe a little bit too. But Tatum or the C's, where are we starting? Go.
In the big picture, Rich, the comeback is probably like more historic, but I have to go Tatum here.
Gotta
because
go
I think the 60-point performance, in my mind, you look at this, Rich, and you know, everyone, there's been a lot talked about Tatum all year long in terms of the ups and downs and his tough battle coming back from COVID. But a lot of guys have posted 60 points in their career in recent history here. And, you know, Carmelo, Kemba, Lillard, et cetera. But very few, I feel like, have posted a 60 like Tatum has, where it comes in the flow of the game. Like there was no time in this game where, okay, let's just look for Tatum because we want to get him those extra points, a la, you know, Devin Booker at the Garden a few years ago. This was 60 points in the flow of a game against a team playing really well in the Spurs, not defensively, but they just, like, you know, they brought it that night. And he just did, again, they would have been down by 50 in the first half if he wasn't the only guy who could score those points. But to me, this was, you put up a ranking of top 60-point performances in recent NBA history, and Tatum has to be, I think, like, top five in terms of just the degree of difficulty that we saw on Friday night.
And you talk about, I think, what Clay and Carmelo, the only other two guys to have 60 and have zero turnovers. And you talk about a guy whose his usage rate was approaching 40, I think, for the game, and to have zero turnovers is unbelievable. And it's also an interesting performance in the sense that, like, the first half of it, I mean, a lot of, you just did, I mean, not that people weren't paying attention, but there was enough, they're down 30 points.
Right.
You know, it's like someone's got to score. It's okay. Like, I assume that a large portion of Celtics fans had tuned out, probably weren't even watching the game at that point. But, you know, you would never think at that point as he's putting up those numbers that he's actually keeping the Celtics in it when they're continuing to fall farther and farther behind to the point that they're actually 32 points behind. But that all went in. That was all ingredients in this historic performance. So it should have been 61. Hopefully he'll have another chance to top that. I'm sure he will before it's all said and done.
But I like that they're still tied, though. I like that. He got screwed out of the continuation there, but it's nice that he gets to share that with Bird for now and then just have that be an extra. And I don't know if you, like, it's pretty incredible how similar his scoring line was to Bird. If you look at just their pure box score stats, Tatum, 20 of 37 from the field, 15 of 17 from the line, 60 points. Bird, 22 of 36 from the field, 15 of 16 from the line, 60 points on that March 12th, 1985 matchup against the Hawks. And did you see anyone from the Spurs bench going nuts after, you know, the comments? That was the one thing that Tatum was missing out on.
I saw Pop went nuts a few times. I don't think that was in celebration of Tatum, though.
So he was asked about this after the game. I actually looked up to see what Pop said about it. And he just, like, I don't want to talk about it. He totally, like,
I don't blame him.
Which again is actually right. It's like, but I thought, like, you know, he coached Tatum this summer, maybe be like, yeah, you know, this is the guy. But he was more just like, I don't care. Like, we just lost a 32-point lead. Like, go screw.
Yeah, I think you probably ask him that over the summer if Pop's walking around a summer league, or if you walk into bump into him at a wine bar in Vegas. I think that's when you ask him to wax on that legendary performance. I said, did you catch the just where Tatum scored from? I thought that was interesting too. You know, 26 points in the paint. 26 points in the paint. For a guy that all season we've been begging, get first of all, get into the paint. Second of all, get to the line. 15 points from the foul line. I think his career high for makes and attempts in a game, right? 15 to 17.
Yep.
15 points on 5 3-pointers, and then 4 from the mid range. And I think, and I'm pretty sure that his first hoop of the game was a mid range jumper. So the first two, or somewhere, one of his first few buckets was from mid range. So after that, only one mid range hoop. it was just, like you said, it was just the way he did it. The versatility, the consistency, you know, doing it, you know, when your team's down 30, doing it when you're now down 15 in the fourth quarter. And then again, did he sit in the fourth quarter in OT?
No, I don't think he sat at all. I think he played straight through.
Right, you talk about a guy that's been dealing with that conditioning and the inhaler and just put the team on his back. 60 points. Again, you get the sense that it's not the last one we're going to see out of him. I personally, let's not take this performance then put up the expectations and put more pressure on him to do it again. But just the way he did it, it just seems pretty sustainable.
Yeah. Again, that in the Spurs, certainly not a team known for the defense, not having like wing defenders there, but you know, they had a legit shot blocker in there and Pirtle down low. So it's not like he was going up against, you know, scrubs by any means, but he just, again, knew where he wanted to go on the floor every time. Brad Stevens said after the game, we needed every one of those points to win. And again, like they would have been down by 50 in the first half because he was the only guy who came to play out of the gate. I think no one else in the team scored until like late in the first quarter of if nothing else. So, and do you want to, so I'll do this real quick for you, Rich. There's, I believe, 11 guys who have scored 60 or plus points since 2010.
Okay, so full disclosure, I peeked at your tweet.
You peeked at the list. Okay, so
no, so it was you tweeted about it. I didn't read through the whole list. I mean, I saw, you know, Melo. I know Clay. I know Kemba's on there, which I would not have guessed probably, right, if not seeing your tweet. I mean, Beal did, yep, it as well. The Steph got 60.
Yep.
Tony Delk. No, he only had 50. He's not list of 50 guys. That's pretty unbelievable.
One came at the Garden a couple years ago.
One came at the Garden a couple years ago.
It wasn't a legitimate one. Jay Crowder got really upset about it after the game.
Oh, the Garden. You know, that's pretty messed up that I was thinking about MSG.
You're thinking of MSG? Oh.
But sorry. Booker,
right?
Obviously. Is Kobe on that list?
Kobe's on that list.
His right, exactly. His last one. Who am I missing? LeBron?
LeBron, yep. LeBron's on there. And then you got two more. These guys have done it multiple times because they just are, you know, the top scorers, you know, arguably.
Oh,
the top
Dame had 60.
Yep. And one guy the Celtics will probably see in a, you know, in a month if he's healthy in the second round of the playoffs.
Oh, and B, oh, Harden.
Yes, James Harden. So
I saw the tweet that Tatum broke Kyrie's record for most points scored in an NBA game by a former Duke player.
Ooh.
Kyrie had 57, I think, was the leader. Now JT is all alone in 60. Just unbelievable. I'm trying to look through the notes here if there's any other random. I'd say the first player in Celtics history to have multiple 50-point games in a season.
Right. Like, yeah, to do that, you know, within 2 weeks of each other is kind of nuts, especially in this wild season. And I guess the other cool thing, I think, is till the very end, like making the right play. You know, you're on the verge of 60 in overtime, you know, one possession game. You drive the lane, you make the extra pass, you get Jaylen Brown to three in the corner to win the game. And then you end up getting 60 anyway through free throws after the fact. So you get rewarded for just making the right play. So again, this is something where, you know, I think we saw, you know, shades of this from Jump Street rookie year. There's a guy who has the capability of doing this, or that the team obviously had the ambition that he'd be able to, you know, develop into this. But for this to happen this soon with this level of efficiency, I think is you know, something that in a season that's been pretty rough for the team and for the franchise at parts is a nice little reminder that, okay, this is the guy that can still develop into what, you know, this team needs him to be consistently and pull games like this out of his ass.
Yeah. And in a game where, like, you know, maybe the stakes aren't quite what Celtics fans had hoped for. Like, you're not dealing for top seeds, right? You're not in the 1-2-3 conversation, but still a game that the Celtics
very important
really,
game.
Really, really needed. You know, not, as I said, not the stakes that you'd hope for, but not a must win. You're not gonna say must win, but it was a game the Celtics really needed, especially like with Portland coming up tomorrow, and another tough game where they're just, every win matters, and this game was lost. They were down 30. They were down 32 points.
I think it was 99.7 win probability at one point, I think was the exact number, according to Sean Grady.
Yeah, and like you said, like the Spurs are not the Spurs of old, but they're still a very good team. They're a team that came in over 500 in the Western Conference this season. You know, with we got DeRozan with Murray's playing out of his mind. Like you said, Poeltl has been a very solid center. They have a solid team, and it's just unbelievable. I'm talking circles about it, but it's just beautiful to see.
All right, so that's enough drilling over Tatum for now. We'll get back to probably more of that later, but let's talk about the game a little bit more in the sense of, I mean, you mentioned it, the stakes were pretty big in terms of the Celtics just have no margin of error right now if they want to avoid the play-in scenario, given a pretty tough schedule and two head-to-head games with the Heat also upcoming next week that probably will ultimately decide it. But I don't know, in the first half, Rich, like I thought we were watching the 2015 Spurs. Like the Celtics were not good, but the Spurs were, that was magical offense. And they just like, they're hitting everything. They're getting great shots time after time. And to be quite honest, I don't think they dropped off a ton from that. It's not like they like crapped the bed in the second half of this game. Like they were still scoring down the stretch. Like they had a
140 points.
Yeah, they're like the counterpoint just came. Right.
Yeah.
And so like when you look at that, if it's like, yeah, sometimes you can come back from 30 when, you know, a team just like scores 10 points in a quarter or whatever. But this was something different. This was something that's literally having to drag their way back into it, tooth and nail, and running up whatever it was, like 80 plus points in the second half. Like it was nuts. Yeah.
No, like you said, and I think a lot of times if you see a situation like that, you'd expect that team in the Spurs position to kind of just die, roll over and die once they lose that lead. But it was like that was like, you know, that was the first mountain to climb, is erasing the 32 point lead, and they still had another crunch time game on their hands. And that's another thing we can talk about, is another game where the Celtics, you said they're one of their biggest weaknesses all year. They were the worst clutch situation team in the NBA. By a lot, they played the most clutch games. They had the worst winning percentage. They were just horrible. And this is another situation as we're getting closer to where the games really matter in the playoffs, where when it came down to winning time, they made the right decisions. They had the guys step up. They made some shots. You know, all the things that they were just falling short on for the first few months of the season. It obviously helps when you have a player who's scoring 60 points in a game. But like you said, it kind of happened within the flow. It wasn't clear out for JT every time. It was, you know, there were a couple, like the step back three pointer. There are a couple of plays like that where it was just like, okay, this is just ridiculous. But it just kind of came within the flow of the game of a team that seems to be, and it's different. You know, Kemba wasn't out there missing a big piece, but seems to be maybe starting to find a little bit more identity. I mean, they didn't have any real identity before that, but it just seems like you're getting closer.
Well, what do you think? What is the biggest development from this game in your mind? Because in my mind, it's not Tatum scoring 60 points. There's a different element, a different part of this game that is a bigger picture development for the Celtics.
The man I like to call Knees, I think. Is that what we're talking about, Mr. Neesmith?
I think that is Aaron Neesmith.
And I think what really makes that important. Like if this was just game one of sort of Aaron Neesmith kind of starting to show what he can do, that's one thing. But that's back to back games.
Yes, and 100%. This is coming off a career night, following up with another career night,
back to back career high scoring, and then 9 rebounds in the first game, 6 rebounds in the second one. But like in the win against Charlotte, 3 steals and 3 blocks.
Right, like he helped change the game in that game, because the Celtics came out flat again out of the gate in the first quarter of that game, and obviously we saw how the first half unfolded here. And I mean, Neesmith was certainly a part of that in the first half, but he's just everywhere, and now he's starting to, I think, just figuring out how to harness that energy better, Rich, of like not getting too over aggressive on defense, and like, you know, he's crashing the glass hard. He's running around screens hard, and now the shot's coming around, and now there's actually confidence there, because what's happened here is like, I thought he, we talked about, he played pretty well defensively when he got a chance in February there in the rotation.
He competed at the very, least. Yeah.
But he wasn't shooting. He wasn't looking for a shot. Like, he was kind of just there and wasn't giving you anything. And so Brad went away from him. And then obviously Romeo Langford got a shot here, but Romeo Langford just looks like the same guy as last year. And that's still a guy who's shooting like 25% from three and, you know, 35% from the field. So that's not going to get the job done here. And I know he, and it's, you almost going to give him a mulligan for the season. I mean, because of the wrist situation and then COVID, it's like, you know, what could, you can't really expect a huge growth for a guy out of this, but Nesmith has slowly been coming along here, and now the minutes are back to him. And now I think it's only two or three games, but I think he's, from a athleticism standpoint, from a, just a, an energy standpoint, it's hard to see, you know, Langford taking back those minutes from him, you know, once this team's back at full strength.
Or Fournier.
Yeah, I mean, Fournier, he played over Fournier, which is, and again, credit to, like, Brad has not been good at this year in terms of just like giving guys minutes for the sake of giving the minutes when they don't deserve it. But this was like, Fournier had just been so brutal in these first three or four games. And you know, you want to let him play through, but there is a point where it's like, you gotta win games. And luckily Fournier didn't actually play that bad last night. He was, you know, he was 3 of 6. He actually hit a couple shots, which was in the comeback, which was nice. But yeah, there's no question that Nesmith was the better player on the floor. And so you roll with that guy, and they reap the dividends because of it.
Yeah, no, it's just the energy. And I think I remember, you know, Doc Rivers, 50-50 balls. This is the one thing that I remember him always harping on, such an important part. Just winning, that a lot of times can be the difference in those close situations, right? Just getting those 50-50s. Nesmith brings that energy. He brings that level of intensity, has the speed, has the quickness, has the athleticism to where if he wants to mix it up, and it seems pretty clear that he is a guy who's willing to do that. Maybe he realizes that's his key. Right. And you can understand some of these guys. You go in and he didn't even play that much in college, but when you've been when you've been Jason Tatum at every level, right? Like you kind of maybe know how to play one way, but maybe it took a few months for him to realize, hey, I'm not that guy anymore. Maybe I can be at some point, but if I need to assume the identity of a role player, someone who's just going to do just do the dirty work, and he was willing to do that. And you can still see the ways where he can improve and hopefully will. Like, you know, the one play that jumps out to me, I think it was maybe a minute or so left in the game, where he got out on that breakaway and tried the Euro step and kind of missed. You can see that play happening even a month from now, certainly next year, where he gets out in the break and that's just so much slower. It's so much under control. He knows what he's doing and he finishes that layup. But you could see that he was just going a million miles an hour in that moment. So you can see the times where the game still needs to slow down a little bit and he can improve. But man, like, for someone who, if we'd had this conversation last week, 2 weeks ago, who you're saying, you know, I had the conversation with Ryan and Tom, like, hey, is Jabari Parker going to, is it going to be an afterthought by the time we get to the playoffs? Like, is Jabari Parker in the playoff rotation? It seems that that's been answered. We were all pretty clear that it was going to be a no. But right now, I can you say for sure? Is Aaron Nesmith going to play in the playoffs?
Yes.
Like, I think I'm not convinced quite yet.
Because, well, let's work through this right now. You have, I think you have seven locks in your rotation. I think you have eight, because I think it's safe to say Peyton Pritchard is a lot to be in the rotation of the playoffs. Like,
you need him, yeah.
I think so. I think. So your starting five is Kemba, Smart, Rob, Tatum, and Jalen. And then coming off your bench, you have Tristan, you have Fournier, and then you have Pritchard. And then, so who's your ninth guy going to be? So yeah, it's going to depend on the matchup, but I think Nesmith is certainly going to get first crack at it, because Grant has just not been a net positive this year, like, for whatever reason. I mean, he's hitting threes at a better rate than ever, which is great, but like, every other part of his game is just not nearly as consistent or reliable as it was last year. And that's, you know, it's not something that's going to define him. It might just be a sophomore slump for just a down year for him. But beyond that, like, Shemmy, we've seen that story play out in the playoffs before. Jabari Parker, like, you might as well just put a target on his back if you want to play him in the playoffs defensively, when you really can't afford it given how the rest of the team plays. And yeah, Romeo, like, is Romeo better than Nesmith defensively in certain matchups, absolutely. But from an energy standpoint, like, I'd rather have Nesmith run into walls, I think, in the playoffs as opposed to Romeo at this point, especially when teams can just ignore him at the 3-point line.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I'm looking at the box score from yesterday right now, and Grant played 8 minutes, Tremont played six and change. Other than that, they played eight guys.
Yeah,
and even Pritchard played 13 minutes. Well, you know, one of his least effective games, or at least in terms of like just getting run. So they really played. And if talking about guys who played more than 20 minutes, you had seven guys, and Fournier just barely made it. Maybe that is a glimpse. Obviously, you're going to add Kemba to that mix, and that's going to, you know, you would think maybe take even more time away from Peyton. I just don't, you know, for me, I'm not sure. I think it's asking a lot of Nesmith. I think it would be nice if, yeah, maybe he does get a crack at earning that playoff a spot in the rotation. I think it might be a little too much this year to expect him to run with it. It would be amazing. Obviously, it's a game changer if somehow you can get this Aaron Nesmith of the last two games in the second round of a series against Brooklyn, right?
No question. And if it's like, is he going to start hitting shots? And he's hitting shot. Like, again, it's like we think you're getting this guy, you draft him. It's like, okay, you're getting the sharpshooter, and we don't know much else about him. Not much of a defender. It's like the polar opposite has played out here. It's like, okay, he's a high motor defensive guy, and now maybe the shot's going to come along too. And then consistency, he's got a long way to go. He's had two strong games, but the shot has been iffy all year long. But certainly, if you're defending him, you have to respect him a lot more than pretty much anyone else in the Celtics bench outside of Pritchard from distance, just based on his track record. So like,
yeah, and I was going to say, I'll say that there's only 1 month this year that Nesmith played more than 100 minutes. So he's played 136 minutes in April, played 166 minutes in February. And he shot 42% from three. Hmm. He was 8-19. So I think that he showed that when he can get into like any shooter, right? Like it's tough to, it's when you're, and he was labeled, they said he was the best shooter in the draft coming in. But if that is your job, I think it's hard to have spotty playing time, to never know when you're coming off the bench, to sit out multiple games in a row and then have them like dust you off and throw you out there and expect you to hit threes. But he showed in that stretch, nine games in February, that when he gets some consistent playing time, he can shoot. I mean, obviously he can shoot, but he's at 42%. He's shooting 40% in April, 50% from the field. And again, he's not like one of those specialists that's shooting, you know, 80% of his shots from three.
No,
you know, he's getting to the hoop a little bit. Like, he's not afraid. And that's one thing you can say for sure about this guy. Like, he does not look intimidated out there, physically or mentally. And like I said, the playoffs, I think, are a different beast, but let's hope for the best.
One other thing from last night I want to point out, that I think is an encouraging sign. And I like to harp on this, but we'll go here. Marcus Smart, 12 assists, six shots. Awesome.
Yeah.
Like, perfect. And he made a big three in the fourth quarter. We know, wide open one in rotation to, like, you know, keep him in the game there. So like, again, that's good. But like, the recognition here again, and you know, Jalen probably was honestly probably too aggressive at times late in that game. You liked him to be aggressive, but given it wasn't his night, you know, Tatum probably could have had 40, 45 shots and that one. Maybe they would have won it in regulation, to be honest. But like, the fact of the team, like, really fell in line there, and like no one else in the starting five took over six shots. You know, Nesmith obviously was 7-9, so there's no complaints there. And even Tristan Thompson, after eight offensive rebounds, only took eight shots, Rich, which shows you, I think that was that a career high five assists last night? Was that the last thing I brought up, the passing Tristan? That's the key.
That is very true, actually.
That might be the key to this team.
But before we sign off, I'm going to click on Tristan's page right here and see what his...
That's got to be a career high.
Career high. And certainly his Celtics career high. That's fair to say. Assists. He had one six-assist game last year in Cleveland.
Okay.
So against the Bulls. But how many minutes did he play? Oh, yeah, 27 minutes. Know what's amazing? This career high six assists, he was minus 32 in 27 minutes.
So this is the first meaningful game that he's had Femi assist. But again, that's, and I really hope that in the playoffs, he just, I understand for him, like, you do all that hard work down low, and he's like the anti-Tice of like down low, and you get like, Tice probably passes too much down there. I think Zach Lowe had a great clip in his 10 things this week on ESPN.com of Tice just like having a 6 foot guy down low under him, and he got the pass, but he always passes it out for the three, no matter what. And it's like, dude, you're 6 foot eight, like, finish it. And Tristan's the opposite of that, of being like, okay, you know, you're amazing at getting these offensive rebounds or, you know, these mismatches, but sometimes you're too determined just to get it right back up no matter what, even though you're not good at finishing most of the time. If Tristan just gets that happy medium of like, okay, yeah, finish against the smaller guys, but like, you know, look out for the kick out, that those open looks are probably going to be the difference in a couple of these playoff games, I feel like, if the rest of the Celtics offense is running.
Well, especially when he can see that. I mean, there's few people as good in the league as Rob as making that quick kick out. And you say, if Tristan can just see that and right. see how effective it can be, let's just learn something from the young guy. No, it's interesting. There's not only was the five assists his Celtics career high, but 15 rebounds.
Yes.
Was his career high as a Celtic.
I mean, again, another under the right, like, Tatum had the career night, but there were two other career nights in that game. And again, that's what you need to come back from 32 points. You, Tatum doing that by himself, they still would have lost by like 15 with him putting up the 16. He wouldn't have been obviously on the floor long enough to do that. But you got Nesmith coming up big. You got Tristan Thompson doing the dirty work down low. You have Smart just making the right place. And Jaylen coming up with the big three after a really rough shooting night. So it was a pretty, again, a game that, you know, it's the Spurs are a 500 team, but they do have the best road record, I think, in the West, or close to it. They're 18-12 on the road. So they clearly, I thought they looked like the 2015 Spurs for a lot of that game, like the ball movement. And it was just like, and everything going down. So for them to shoot 53% and for the Celtics to come back despite a team shooting 53% is pretty nuts to me.
Yeah, like we said, like the comeback was only part of the battle. Like right through the end of the fourth quarter, right through overtime, the Spurs were playing hard, and they were playing well. I mean, certainly there's something's going wrong if you're blowing 32 point lead, but they didn't roll over, and that would have as great as the comeback was, as great as the 60 point game, you know, ultimately was, you know, losing that game after the comeback. I think at one point, you know, Bernardoni tweeted, "There are no moral victories here. You got to get the win." And that was true. That would have been, even with the comeback, even with Tatum's heroics, that would have been an absolutely brutal loss if they had dropped that game in overtime. And I think that they showed a lot just holding on, getting over the top, and doing what they needed to do.
100%. They've lost too many of those this year. For, like I said, they're at the point in the season where you just can't afford them anymore if you want to avoid the play-in game, which is still very much a play even after this win. And then even on top of that, if you want to avoid the Bucks in the first round, like if you want to give yourself a legitimate chance to face off with the Nets. We'll end on this. We got about, what, 9 games left in the season right now. Who is your ideal, you know, who do you want to face out of the top three juggernauts if you have to, either in the first or second round? You might have to face one of them in the first round. It might have to be the Bucks if you're the sixth seed, or obviously if you get stuck in the playing situation, one of the Nets or Sixers. But who, given how things are playing out with injuries and how these teams are looking, like who do you think the Celtics would have the best chance at in that kind of scenario?
It's tough. I mean, I think right now, I think maybe, and it feels weird saying this because I was talking about how combustible Embiid might still be, and Simmons, you never quite know what you're going to get. I mean, I think that I might fear the Sixers the most.
Really?
I mean, they're certainly the fact that Brooklyn still has the one seed is impressive just with everything that they've been going through in this, like the merry-go-round of, you know, Kyrie and KD, and now Harden's going to be out for a while. Like, again, they seem to believe that they can, the playoffs will start. They're all going to come back healthy, and that they'll just be able to cruise. And I'm not entirely convinced of that. I, you know, Would you be shocked if Kyrie needs to, you know, needs a few mental health days like randomly when the play, and I'm not making a joke. Like I think it's clear that like he's that's part of the Kyrie experience. Now, every once in a while, he's just going to need some time to himself. And I don't think you can rule out him needing that in the playoffs. And who knows how long a KD has been hurt a few different times this year. Obviously you just look on paper, you're terrified of them. And then you get Milwaukee, and you know Giannis is dealing with an ankle injury right now, right?
He got hurt the other night. And honestly, I wouldn't be shocked if going back to the Nets for a second, like I wouldn't be shocked if like Harden doesn't play in the first round or something like that, based on you know how careful they're probably going to be with this hamstring injury after he re-aggravated it. Now, you know not against a team like the Celtics. If they face the Celtics in the first round, they might be afforded. But if they you know end up with the Heat or just some other weekend, like a weekend Hawks team or something like that, maybe they're like, yeah, you know, we'll give it an extra 2 weeks, James, and we'll see you in the second round when we need you.
Yeah, that's weird. I would say it's crazy to say, given you know all they've been through recently, but the Sixers do feel like the most functional or the least dysfunctional, we'll say, team up top. Not that the Bucks are necessarily dysfunctional, but this doesn't. I don't necessarily get a great vibe from them.
They're, I don't know. Like defensively, they're not the same this year. Like they're not that they were the same last year, but like they're losing, you know, their offense is amazing, but their defense, their bench unit is not as good as past years. So, I mean, we'll see. Their Jrue Holiday is a legitimate upgrade. And like, if you avoid the play-in situation, like, but you still get the six, like you're probably still toast, like in the first round, because you're facing the Bucks in the first round, like, and they're at full strength, and like,
right,
that's going to be a very tall mountain to climb. So I still think, again, you got 8-9 games left. You control your own destiny here. You face the Heat twice, you face the Knicks once, and you have a bunch of very winnable games in between there. And so, you know, you finish this off of 6-3, 7-2. You're probably in a good spot to get in that 4 or 5 spot and face a Julius Randle and a bunch of supporting pieces in that first round, and which would be a really fun series, but a very winnable one at that.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, we'd probably prefer for the Knicks to beat the hell out of, you know, one of the other teams, but who knows? Yeah, I guess if the other option is facing Milwaukee, right?
Right. It's like, who you want? You want the Knicks or Milwaukee? You want the Knicks or LA, obviously. But
yeah,
there's no walkovers this year when you're in the bottom half of the Eastern Conference. So, all right, well, we'll wrap it up there. We'll look a lot more closer at this these playoff scenarios as the week gathers on here. But this was an emergency edition of the Winning Plays podcast on a Saturday.
Nice little fun
look back at Tatum's 60 points. So, yep, hit us up at Winning Plays Pod on Twitter, at _ Rich Levine, at Brian T. Robb. And I'm heading back on paternity leave for a little bit longer, but I'll still be on the podcast here and there. So stay tuned for that.